if Biden wins and Trump refuses a peaceful transition of power, we have to have something in play.
Labor activists say they are prepared for a general strike to defend their hard-earned gains.
They've been breaking the law since before the pandemic. They should be taken to prison in handcuffs.
And in California, app companies spent nearly $200 million on an effort to defeat an initiative designed to protect drivers' rights.
If Bolivia were able to return to democracy as a left-wing, progressively governed country, it would mark a major defeat of the Trump administration.
And indigenous people of Bolivia go to the polls to cast their votes with an overwhelming tendency to support the movement towards socialism. Observers ask, will the U.S. and its European allies respect the results of this election after they supported the coup d'etat against the winners of the last one? From Pacific Radio, this is COVID, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. The dangers posed by Donald Trump to the nation and the international community appear to be multiplying exponentially the closer we get to November 3rd. On October 2nd, the president contracted the coronavirus, and before long, all the president's men and women, at least 22 people across Trump's White House, political campaign, and military leadership, had also contracted the deadly virus at one of the numerous super spreader events hosted at the White House. The country doesn't really know yet if Trump has cleared the virus from his system. But the president has taken his super spreader events on the campaign trail, exposing thousands of people who will certainly not have access to the ruling class medical care that got Trump back on his feet days after he was administered oxygen. At past rallies, Trump has praised his predominantly white audience for their, quote, good genes. He claims to have saved millions of lives from the coronavirus. Yet the United States has lost 216,000 people unnecessarily to COVID-19, and that's one of the highest death rates in the world. Without a sense of irony, Trump has also called his super spreader rallies protests against stupidity, and that's one of his tweets, literally. In the last 3 weeks, he called his protests and rallies protests against stupidity. And now he's peddling a herd immunity approach to the pandemic, a strategy widely condemned by science. We all seem to be living in Trump world, where up is down and wrong is right, and the dangerously wicked witch literally has 9 lives. Here to discuss the psychology of this moment, we welcome Dr. Bandy Zenobia Lee. Dr. Lee is an American forensic psychiatrist at Yale University and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. I think it's important for our listening audience to be reminded of what exactly you predicted and what has been the course of the danger and decline in American society that we are seeing before us. And I'm asking you to lay it out for us, because even among those who paid attention and who are paying attention, there also seems to be an incredulity. And I think that this is something that accompanies the malaise that you describe as narcissistic personality disorder.
Yes, it's not just malaise. It's being co-opted into the president's pathology. I wouldn't necessarily give a diagnosis to it, because diagnosis is usually by exclusion. You need all the medical records and so on. So, but we do know that pathological narcissism plays a role, and sociopathy plays a role. And those are not the only factors, even. Psychosis may play a role, as well as, well, we know of many specialists commenting on his cognitive decline.
Can you describe sociopathy?
Yes. Sociopathy, many people relate it to the diagnosis antisocial personality disorder, and certainly antisocial personality is a part of that. But as someone who works with violent offenders, and I mainly practice in prisons, I do see a lot of sociopathy, and that is actually my specialty. I characterize it as human beings who are lacking in human characteristics when one is sociopathic. In other words, the slightest inconvenience or the slightest pleasure would be reason enough and justification enough to take another life. We see those tendencies, unfortunately, in the president.
Is Trump just an extension of the pathological leaders we've seen, like Biden, who've deployed horrific policies in the United States? This is the quote by Eric Frum. A society that lacks the means to provide adequately for the majority of its members, or a large proportion of them, must provide these members with a narcissistic satisfaction of the malignant type if it wants to prevent dissatisfaction among them. But I want you to answer the question, is Trump the same as every other leader who's deployed war and destruction around the world?
No, because there are many reasons one might deploy violence, and we have violent structures to start with, and certain individuals may be simply channeling or magnifying the violent structures. Donald Trump brings a psychology that is dangerous for many erratic reasons, in addition to being attracted to and amplifying the violent structures.
And that was Dr. Bandy Zenobia Lee. Dr. Lee is an American forensic psychiatrist at Yale University and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. President Donald Trump's refusal to pledge respect for the upcoming November election results and his apparent sympathies for white supremacist groups is prompting people to look for ways to protect what they perceive as their democratic rights. Steve Seltzer spoke to Dan Maloney, president of the Rochester Labor Council.
So, you know, we're seeing these moves by President Trump right now to kind of dismantle the Postal Service and kind of throw discord, kind of sowing seeds of doubt in the voters' minds about, and, you know, in this day and age with the coronavirus still in the middle of a pandemic, most folks aren't comfortable of a certain age or if you have medical conditions going into a polling place live and casting your ballot. And, of course, most states are making options for people. And the biggest and best option is a mail-in ballot. So, of course, the president and I'll say his henchmen are going after that institution the hardest. So, you know, DeJoy and all the things they've been doing with the sorting machines and removing the blue box from the corner where people used to drop off mail and cutting heads and cutting overtime and all the things they're doing to disrupt the U.S. Postal Service. It's wrong, and of course there are union brothers and sisters, and so we're trying to defend them, and in the course of that, we're trying to defend American democracy itself by instilling confidence in your mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, during this important presidential election.
And he's also told people, the right-wingers in Michigan, to liberate the state. There have been kidnapping threats against politicians. Did you ever in your lifetime think you'd see a situation in the United States where the president was inciting people to basically attack elected officials?
No, and of course we have to stay on guard, right? This is a participatory sport, democracy. So everybody, all oars in the water, pulling in the same direction, we can move the ship of state. And right now, you know, there's a pirate trying to take it over. So we are here to try, again, to defend, you know, the vote, the will of the people. And, you know, it's just kind of telling in the nationally televised debate that the president wouldn't say that he would, in fact, respect the will of the people and the outcome of this election. He should have been saying that clearly and loudly. So it's just kind of it's a tell as to what his plans are.
And your resolution, why don't you talk about your resolution and also what was the discussion in the Labor Council about the resolution?
Bottom line here, some of the whereas, the president has failed on multiple occasions to denounce the activity of white supremacist and fascist militias and organizations that have a stated desire to overthrow American democracy. That's true. Again, in that debate, he was given a clear choice, and he said, stand by, Proud Boys, stand at the ready kind of deal. Whereas, we're polarized right now, and, you know, it's kind of become more of a sport, you know, us against them, winner take all between the Republicans and Democrat, polarized nation. And it seems like the Republicans have actually just given up to this potential dictator or, you know, a tyrant in training here, Donald Trump. And their role, the Congress's role as part of the checks and balance system, or the judiciary, the Supreme Court, have been diminished to the point that somebody could take over as a fascist dictator in this country. Seems unheard of, right? But we're seeing these moves, these steps being taken. So, of course, as it says, we oppose authoritarianism and totalitarianism, and we are here to fight against it and ensure the institutions of democracy in our nation remain vigorous. And, I mean, one of the tools that we can use to ensure that is the power of a general, national general strike. And, I mean, that's something they do in New York City, for example, right? When unions are being, when they're under threat, when they're being gutted, they can always just refuse to pick up the garbage, let it pile up. It starts getting nasty in the middle of July when you got piles of garbage out in front of your buildings in New York City, and typically that brings people to the bargaining table and to common sense solutions in negotiations. So this man, showing he's a tyrant, you have to take strong action to be able to beat him back at his own game. So if that means everything stops across this country, which we can in labor and other people of good conscience, other organizations, church groups, other workers that are not unionized yet can take action. In this case, put down your tools, right? Do not drive the rig. Airplanes don't go up. Trains don't move. Garbage doesn't get picked up. Nothing gets built. Nothing gets sold. Nothing gets transported. We can do that. And usually you only do that as a nuclear option. And that's what it would be when our democracy is under threat as it is today. And this is only if needed. If Biden wins and Trump refuses a peaceful transition of power, we have to have something in play. And the Congress refuses to do their job, right? We have to have some type of action already planned. And that's what we're asking for here.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica, and we've been talking with Dan Maloney, who is president of the Rochester Labor Council and also president of UAW 1097, about the recent resolution passed by the Rochester Labor Council calling for a general strike.
We now hear from the San Francisco Mime Troupe, a democratically run, multi-ethnic, multi-generational, multicultural gender-balanced theater of social justice that by its very existence sustains a vision of community governance of, by, and for the people.
And now we return to It Came From R&D.
Greg, I've been following you all day.
You have?
Since you walked into research and development at Jamazon.
You work for Jamazon?
Oh, no, Greg. Quite the opposite.
What do you want?
I want you to help us.
To do what?
To save America.
From what?
From itself.
Wow.
We have an election coming up this fall, Greg, and a lot of people are feeling pressure. Pressure to think a certain way, pressure to speak a certain way, even to vote a certain way. But that's not the American way. We want citizens to vote the way they really feel, inside, without all the deep state propaganda and the mainstream media hype.
Of course.
And wouldn't it be great if there was some app or an algorithm that would decipher what people really want from all their posts and music and tweets and emails and searches, and then just vote for them, vote the way they wish they could. Wouldn't that be freedom?
Clia!
Clia! And with some states still on lockdown and mail-in ballots so unreliable.
She would be perfect!
Perfect.
But wait, how do you know people won't vote the way they want without Clia? They're not slaves.
Greg, who are you planning to vote for this fall?
Well, I was thinking about Biden.
Clia, who would Greg like to vote for this fall?
Greg sees himself as a social progressive, but a fiscal conservative. He does not realize that enacting social justice and enforcing civil rights costs money, and that's the first funding cut by conservatives. Greg does not think of himself as a racist or sexist, but is frightened of losing his skin and gender privileges in a more equitable society. Greg was raised in the working class, but has accepted the idea that being a worker is a negative, and that happiness is being able to give orders. Greg also believes the stock market will go down with a change of administration. Greg will not admit it to himself, but he would be relieved if Donald Trump were reelected.
No!
It's your algorithm.
Greg does not like the president, but from his comments, texts, reading lists, news feed, and anonymous posts, he believes his personal economy will be better with a crooked businessman in the White House.
Thank you, Clia. Now, Greg, wouldn't it be better to let Clia vote on your behalf for what you really, truly want?
What I want?
Think about it. If we could get Clia on phones and tablets and computers across the country before the election, an app that votes for us based on who we really are without all the Me Too, Black Lives Matter guilt, without any anger about rent or schools or homelessness, and without whatever the hell Antifa wants. No more lines at the polls. Just load Clia on your phone and ping! Meaningful, real democracy.
But what if you got hacked? The whole election would be a lie.
You let us worry about that. All you have to do is license Clia to us for this one election. It would mean a lot of money. You could finally be your own boss.
And after this election?
We probably won't need it again.
He'll think about it.
I'll think about it.
You do that. I'll let you out here. Another protest. Don't you think they're inconvenient?
No.
Clia?
He does.
Of course. Well, I hope you get through safely. If only there was something we could do about all this unrest.
Is that what I really want?
That's what the algorithm says.
Land of the free. Raise up your fist if you want it to be. Home of the brave. Take to the streets if you are. Slavery's chains have never been broken. The forge still remains. So for justice we stand. 'Cause power concedes nothing without our demand.
And that was San Francisco Mime Troupe. You can find out more about them at sfmt.org. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. Stay with us.
United, we're as strong as a mountain. United, we're as deep as the sea. Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united and free.
the fore. He got smiles on, he got faces. The nation's heart beat here once more. Those in power knew just what they wanted. Divide and rule was their cry. Tears they grieve. Angry men and angry women awaken from complacent sleep. Fill the borders till the highlands, council house or castle walls, Kirkan chapel. Came together for one cause.
United we're as strong as a mountain. United we're as deep as the sea. Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united.
Was made for referendum, one vote to let the people know. Is it self-determination? A simple answer, yes or no.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Johanna Fernandez. Hundreds of gig workers and trade unionists rallied last week in San Francisco at the world headquarters of Uber. They protested the company's efforts to turn back workers' gains obtained through California's Assembly Bill 5, or AB 5. This state law requires these gig companies to provide workers' compensation, unemployment, and social security to drivers. In an effort to thwart this initiative, Uber and four other companies are spending nearly $200 million in support of Proposition 22 to overturn workers' protections under AB 5. Let's hear the workers describe the labor conditions they face during the current pandemic.
Uber and Lyft have been breaking the law since January 1st, 2020. They've been breaking the law since before the pandemic. They should be taken to prison in handcuffs.
My name is Erica Maghetto, and I've been a Lyft driver for nearly 4 years and 10,000 rides. When I started driving years ago, I thought rideshare was an okay gig. As time went on, pay cuts became more frequent, and maintenance costs began to mount. I was forced to work 62 hours a week just to squeak by. And I speak for myself and hundreds of drivers I know when I say I'm sick of being bullied by these companies. Instead of rewarding those of us who've worked for Uber and Lyft for years, they cut our bonuses. Uber and Lyft deactivate drivers and discard people in the name of profit and in the interest of the corporate bottom line. drivers like myself become homeless while Uber and Lyft become billionaires. And when I say drivers like myself, I mean, I know what it's like to feel thrown away like broken tools in the Uber and Lyft toolbox. My partner and I have been housing insecure for nearly a year now. We've been bounced between sleeping in our car, at campsites, and at Airbnbs. And it's been a real struggle. We work hard for these companies and all they do is bully us. They steal our lunch money and they violate our basic labor rights. Prop 22 would legalize the bullying. It would allow gig companies to continue to mistreat and underpay us. But we're not going to let that happen. We won't stop fighting until we win a living wage, benefits, and a voice on the job. Prop 22 is a threat to not only my life, but to the lives of all drivers and the safety of our community. We are workers who deserve basic labor protections.
Jamie, it's a big deal for me. You know, I'm a single mother. I'm trying to make a living and support my kid. You know, and I need this income. And it's hard because they don't give us the money that we deserve. They don't give us insurance. You know, we don't have sick days if my kid is sick. I have a kid with health issues. You know, if she's sick, that means I have to stay home and take care of that. They're breaking the law right now by not doing AB 5. We won that AB 5 bill, and they're not giving it to us. They don't want to fight it. That's why they put this prop here, and that's not right.
Prop 22 could keep our wages as low as $5 per hour, as denies benefits and rights we badly need, like unemployment, workers' compensation, paid sick leaves, and more. I know how important those rights and benefits are because this fight is personal for me. A few years ago, I was in an accident driving for Lyft, and I needed shoulder surgery. I could work for 8 months. What was I supposed to do to care of my family during this time when this company did nothing to me for help me? Yeah, they don't do nothing. I did, no matter how hard I worked for or how much money I made for this company, they abandoned me then, just like they abandoned all of us when this pandemic began.
My name is Carlos Ramos, and I am a Lyft driver, but I'm also from Bakersfield, California. I joined this thing yesterday. Growing up in Bakersfield, we learned some things. We learned about hard work, and that's what this fight is all about. It's about hard work and about these companies up here saying that our work isn't real, saying that we're not real workers because we work on an app. What do we have to say about that? Are we? No. We are real workers. We deserve rights. We deserve protections. My grandma was a farm worker in the fields in the Central Valley almost 50 years ago. She was a farm worker and she was an organizer. She was fighting a fight that's very similar to the fight we're fighting today. The farmers thought that they weren't workers. They thought that they didn't deserve the things like bathrooms, that they didn't deserve cold water in the fields, that they didn't deserve the right to organize. And 50 years ago, against all the odds, she won. She won through people power. She won through workers standing together and demanding the rights that they deserve. And that's what we're here doing today.
It's Ronnie Simon. I've worked for many gig companies, including Uber, Lyft, Handy. I've had too many instances where I've had my money that I was supposedly earning taken away, had my tips stolen by the company. I was lured into the company being told I was going to make $19 an hour, but one day I only made $6 the whole day. So that's why I'm here today. Came all the way from Los Angeles to send a message to Uber and Lyft, let them know we are not going to stand for it. We're going to make them follow California's labor laws, and we're going to make sure that people vote no on 22.
This
These companies have spent close to $200 million promoting this greed. App-based business models are innovative. Exploiting workers is not. Prop 22 exploits workers. I want Uber to hear the strength of the working force. On three, we're gonna yell, vote no on Prop 22. Vote no on Prop 22!
On August 10th, 2020, the Superior Court of San Francisco ruled that Uber and Lyft violated AB 5 and misclassified their workers. Since Proposition 22 would consider app-based drivers to be independent contractors and not employees, state employment-related labor laws would not cover app-based drivers. The U.S. Constitution, ratified on September 17, 1787, only allowed white men to vote. On February 3, 1870, the 15th Amendment was ratified, giving African men, in theory, the right to cast their ballot. And it was the Voting Rights Act, signed into law on August 6, 1965, that gave everyone the right to vote. But none of that effectively stopped voter intimidation, discouragement, or manipulation such as gerrymandering or redistricting. To that effect, Dr. Martin Luther King once said, "Voting is the cornerstone of political action." Craig Washington is a former 18th District Congressional Representative in Houston, Texas. Washington explained to Dr. Obadike Kamau of KPFT why the practice of voter suppression continues to be a challenge in Harris County.
We are in Harris County, Texas, fourth largest county in the country, and we're involved in early voting now. There's a raft of lawsuits going on about mail-in voting, and of course, the president has made this a national issue and tried to cast aspersions on mail-in voting. Some people don't want to necessarily mail in their voting, and there are generally points where you can drop your ballot off without it going through the mail, and you feel like you have more control over when it's received. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, recently decided there will only be one drop-off place per county, and there's no logical reason for that. Harris County, I believe, is 2,000 square miles, more than 4 million people, and there's only one place that you can drop off ballots, and that's at NRG, where the professional football team plays. That was stopped, but it's an appeal. What's your take on voter suppression and things? What do people have to do to unsuppress the vote, if you will?
Without going back over previous history to the poll tax and counting beans, it's an evolutionary process. Leopards don't change their spots. They'll try something that doesn't work. When I was at Prairie View as an undergraduate student, we had the audacity to form an organization called SELF, Students for Equality, Liberty, and Freedom. I wasn't the president of it, but I led a march from the campus where we walked 15 miles to the voter registration place in the closest town, which was Hempstead, to register to vote. We were turned down by the voter registrar because we had to sign an affidavit saying we intended to permanently live in Waller County, which was the county in which it was located. That led to a lawsuit. Eventually, as a lawyer, I became a litigant. The first place to crack the egg was Denton, Texas. They had two universities there, North Texas State University and Texas Women's University, and they were trying to do the same thing, register and vote. That was just another aspect, another layer of the voter suppression. It's like throwing stuff in the road. If this doesn't work or the courts rule it out, they'll think of something else. It's pernicious, is what it is. Who would not want a citizen to vote? Someone, I should say, who has an ulterior motive. They perceive that you're not going to vote for the candidate of their choice, so they have two choices. They can either round up more people, or they can decrease the number of people who are going to vote for the other candidate. They don't have the ability to round up more people. They use the other method. They try things like at Hispanic polling places over the years. They've had people show up with khaki pants and white shirts on, pretending to look like INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, what they used to call the Border Patrol, to scare off the people or intimidate the people. They tried the same thing in the black community. There have been instances where they even try to go into the voting booth to peep over the person's shoulder, because some people need assistance from one of the officials. Maybe they're infirm. So if they need assistance, it's under Texas law, the election officials at the polling place have the right, under certain circumstances, to go in, not and cast a ballot, but to instruct them at that moment how to cast a ballot. They've tried every trick in the book, and this is just another layer or nuance of the efforts that they've tried. Since the memory of man runneth not to the contrary.
Let's acknowledge quite openly that voter suppression, historically, it was aimed at black communities, particularly in the South. Now, perhaps that net has widened. But what can the communities that are the target of voter suppression do to minimize these efforts so that they don't have a significant impact on an election?
The shorter answer is vote. If you're not dissuaded by all these antics that they do, when you vote, you can elect people who are not of that ilk and not of that persuasion. In addition to voting, you can participate. You can put out yard signs. You can go to the polls. Persuade everyone that you know to go and vote. The more people vote, the more democracy flourishes. You're born with the right to vote. You have to come of age in order to be able to cast a vote, because all jurisdictions require some semblance of maturity to be able to make an intelligent decision for yourself. Once you arrive at that point, it's incumbent upon you to go and vote. If they wanted to make sure that everyone voted, they would make not voting illegal. Everything that we as a society want to prohibit, we make a crime. Not everything, but most of the things that the courts allow us, they'll never make it a crime not to vote, because they don't want you to vote. And the reason they don't want you to vote is because there's more of us than there is of them. And every time they have an election, if we vote for the candidate who best serves our interests, to make this laundry list of check off that you have to agree on these 46 things that the candidate is for in order to decide to vote for that person. It's facetious. It's just another nuanced way of trying to dissuade you. I would rather know how you think than listen to your promises. In fact, your promises turn me off. What turns me on is that I can perceive how you think, and therefore I can project as an educated human being how you would likely vote or speak or amend or act on things that are important to me. It's not quid pro quo, and it never will be. And those that are looking for quid pro quo are likely to be bamboozled, because they're going to go for the greasy pig every time. You can put Hope Diamond and a grain of corn in front of them, and they're looking for corn. They're going to pass up the Hope Diamond.
You continue to insist, and you really don't have a lot of politicians saying this out loud. Elected officials are accountable to the people. They serve us. We don't serve them. That's generally not the way people look at it. Elected politicians, some of them are almost rock stars, and people just want to be in their orbit and get a chance to speak to them or shake their hand. Why do you continually remind people of how that relationship is supposed to work?
That's a very good question. I'm not enamored by the fact that you shake my hand. You watch some of these politicians, and I use the term derisively because that's what it's become. They'll form a rope line, and some of these people think that they can walk by and pat you on the back of the hand as they walk down, the president and any person. They're not shaking you, and they're not stopping to talk to you. They're just touching you on the way down. And if you're enamored by that, then shame on you. I'd rather listen to you and listen to your mind. We have allowed politics to become what it is. The term or the expression that has been coined is speaking truth to power. It's the other side of the coin. Speaking truth to power is not us talking to the politician. It's the politician talking to us. We are the power. If no one votes, no one gets elected.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I am Dr. OBDK Kamau. I am speaking with Craig Washington, who has a well-known lawyer and has been an elected official in Texas. And he served in both the Texas Senate and the Texas State Legislature. He also served in Congress as a representative of District 18 in Houston, Texas. You are in the process of finishing up your memoirs. Can you tell us what that's going to be about and when we should kind of start looking for?
The name of the book is The Craig Washington Roadshow. And my life has been a roadshow. God has sent me to a lot of places, from California to Florida, trying cases. I was a fellow at Princeton University. I was invited at Harvard. I couldn't go because I had a young family and I couldn't be away from them. I'm always aware of who I am. From the day I was born, the doctor woke me up and I haven't been asleep since. People talking about being woke, mm-hmm. I've been awake all the time.
We have been speaking with Brother Craig Washington. We want to tell you to look out for the Craig Washington Roadshow once again. And by all means, go vote. Use discernment when you are making these very important choices. Brother Craig, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for listening.
That was Craig Washington, former 18th District Congressional Representative of Houston, Texas. He spoke to Dr. OBDK Kamau of KPFT. Special thanks to producer Akua Holt.
Salió el hombre en busca de libertad.
Con sus hermanos de clase, el mundo quiso cambiar.
Alzando contra el imperio a los pobres del lugar.
Libraba su guerra de hambre tras muerte y rebelión.
Luchando contra un sistema que quisieron derrumbar. Muchos obreros cayeron defendiendo su verdad.
Con los pobres y oprimidos, con los sin voz ni futuro, buscaban para los suyos la vida con dignidad.
En los tiempos de cambiar, los sueños tienen lugar. Vamos, vamos, vamos buscando, buscando el mundo ideal. Vamos, vamos, forjando sueños a los hijos.
The Andean nation of Bolivia is currently in the eye of the hurricane. Following the pink wave of progressive governments of Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Bolivia, Washington moved its pieces on the political chessboard, reversing the wave. A win of the movement towards socialism in Sunday's presidential election in Bolivia could have a profound impact on Venezuela and Ecuador's political landscape. The question many observers ask is, if the U.S. and its European allies supported last year's coup against MAS, will they respect the results this time around? Producer Polina Vasiliev prepared this report.
Luchando con el consorcio, no dejaron de soñar. Ahogados en la miseria.
In 1611, millions of indigenous people in what is now known as the Nation of Bolivia died to satisfy the appetite of Spain for silver. In 1879, Chile invaded Bolivia in an effort to make money selling Bolivian saltpeter and other minerals. In 1903, Brazil invaded Bolivia to gain access to the nation's rubber production region. In the 1970s and 80s, the U.S. imposed a military dictatorship on Bolivia in order to secure the flow of cocaine into the U.S. markets and the flow of profits into its banking system. And today, once again, the Andean nation lives under a virtual dictatorship in an attempt to give foreigners access to Bolivia's lithium and natural gas. Yet since the election of Aymara leader Evo Morales to executive power, gas and oil profits finally began to be used for the interests of the Bolivian people. Under Evo Morales' administration, Bolivia enjoyed the most stable economy of the continent, and the standard of living of its people grew exponentially. Last November, conservative and neo-fascist sectors of Bolivia staged a coup d'etat that received the blessing of Washington and its allies.
Estamos hartos de 14 años de fraude y corrupción.
Bueno, hemos visto durante todo este tiempo que el centralismo nos ha llevado a lo que tenemos hoy en día.
Sunday, October 18th, was the day Bolivians took to the polls in a key election. Anya Parampil is a journalist with The Gray Zone. She spoke to Pacifica Radio from the Bolivian capital, La Paz, on the day of the election, shortly after the polls had closed.
Leading up to the vote, polls suggested that Luis Arce, the candidate representing the Movimiento al Socialismo Party, or MAS, the party formerly led by ex-president Evo Morales, was poised to win the election and even avoid a runoff or a second round vote against the consensus neoliberal centrist candidate Carlos Mesa. This vote is also significant in the region because if Bolivia were able to return to democracy, return to its process as a left-wing progressively governed country, it would mark a major defeat of the Trump administration's and the U.S. government's overall strategy towards Latin America, which since the Obama years has been to overthrow by means of lawfare or direct military intervention left-leaning governments from Honduras to Brazil. Of course, the Trump administration has ratcheted up pressure on Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Bolivia under Morales previously, and under a potential Arce government would stand in solidarity with these targets of U.S. empire in the region.
Leonardo Flores is the Latin America campaign coordinator with Code Pink. He spoke to Pacifica Radio from La Paz on the day of the elections.
Last year, the Bolivian people voted in presidential elections, but the national media and the OAS, the Organization of American States, created a false narrative of a fraud, which eventually led to the coup, a coup and the ouster of then-President Evo Morales. Since then, there's been an interim government in place, a coup regime, that has violated human rights on a very shocking level. Those violations can be seen in reports from the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and by a report by the Harvard Law School Human Rights Clinic as well.
Wyatt Reed is a journalist and the producer of By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. He spoke to Pacifica from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
In terms of the elections today, we witnessed, a similar paradigm to what we see in so many U.S. elections, that is to say, a lack of resources for the working class voters. When I went first thing in the morning to the northern region, which is much whiter, much wealthier, I found that voters were able to get in and out of the polling stations within a span of 10 to 15 minutes. And this stood in stark contrast to what I found when I went to the San Francisco de Assis College in the southern region of the city, which is much more working class, much more indigenous. There I found a line of over 1,000 people waiting to vote. It took hours for some of them to get in. And we found as we entered that many of the polling stations were actually empty. But the end result was in many ways pretty clear. That is to say, voting becoming such an impediment that it becomes a way of essentially preventing people from voting simply due to the level of inconvenience.
We also spoke to Juan Valdelomar, a MAS sympathizer. He now lives in Los Angeles, but he is originally from the city of Cochabamba, a MAS stronghold.
But when, you know, the coup happened and, you know, the far right government did what they did, because, I mean, they destroyed the economy, they're stealing, corruption, they're arresting people, they're killing, I mean, the massacres of Sencata and Sacaba, I mean, they honestly, they show the world their true colors. And all those Bolivians that were in that gray area now realized, oh, we messed up. I mean, we don't want this for our country. They've arrested people with no proof whatsoever of being sympathizers or members of the MAS party. They and they're not doing that just to you know, politicians. They're also doing that to sympathize. I mean, friends of mine, you know, are being arrested just by like carrying a pamphlet of the MAS. Huh?
Anya Perrenpil from the Bolivian capital.
The United States, the European Union, and its allies, particularly electoral observer missions such as those representing the Organization of American States, which played a major role in validating last year's coup and invalidating the democratic vote which reelected Evo Morales, will do everything in their power in order to obscure the will of the Bolivian people. The United States would much prefer to see Carlos Mesa, the former president of Bolivia, return to power. He is someone who actually oversaw some of the most tense periods in Bolivian history, including the gas wars and a fight over the water sovereignty of the country. As he moved to privatize the water supply, there were massive protests and strikes in Bolivia in 2005, which eventually led to the democratic election of Evo Morales following a major political lockdown and crisis in the country. And so over the last several years, under the guidance of the Movimiento al Socialismo, the party now led by Luis Arce, Bolivia has moved to protect its sovereign natural resources rather than privatize its riches and allow for them to be exploited by foreign capital and industry. And this is upsetting to the United States. And so that's what's driving their desire to reinstall a neoliberal candidate such as Mesa. And considering what we saw last year with the extreme violence in the streets, a massive deployment of military and police, which we also saw in the lead up to this Sunday's vote, it's very clear that they will go to very great lengths and very dangerous lengths in order to get what they want, regardless of what the Bolivian people have decided.
At the heart of the issue is the future of the largest lithium reserve in the world and one of the largest natural gas reserves on the continent. Crucially, the question is, who is going to enjoy the profit from the sales of these resources? Since the recording of the show, the Washington Post has reported that exit polls indicate an insurmountable victory for Luis Arce of the Movement Towards Socialism Party, MAS. Opposition candidate Carlos Mesa has acknowledged his defeat. For Pacifica, I'm Paulina Vasilia.
This concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Seltzer and Polina Vasilyev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasilyev, and Steve Seltzer. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. A note to our listeners. In the October 12th edition, we referred to Leonard Peltier as, quote, a former member of the American Indian Movement, AIM, unquote. That was incorrect.
Leonard Peltier has never renounced his membership in the movement. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for listening.